See, and this is something you could like debate with CFIs. They're like, well, until there's a letter of interpretation, no one knows the answer. And that is true. No one really does know the answer.
Welcome to the Aviation Mentors Podcast, the podcast that takes your dreams of flight and turns it into reality.
Sponsored by Strass Financial, financing your flight training.
For pilots, by pilots. I'm Brandon Martini, a commercial pilot and flight instructor.
And I'm Carson Vasquez, I'm a private pilot.
Whether you're a seasoned pilot or beginner with dreams of flight,
Aviation Mentors is your source for expert insights, industry trends, and inspiring stories.
So fasten your seatbelts and prepare for this incredible journey through the skies.
And stay connected with us on social media for exclusive content.
And visit our website at www.aviationmentors.com and let us be your co-pilot on this adventure.
Welcome back, everybody, to an awesome and, of course, amazing episode of the Aviation Mentors Podcast. Thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it. I hope you're watching us on YouTube by now, because now you get to see our beautiful faces, or at least my beautiful face and semi-Carson's semi-beautiful face.
You have a face made for radio, dude. I don't know what you're talking about. Speechless. Come on.
Speechless. It's not true.
No, you're a beautiful man, Brandon. Is that happy? Does that make you happy?
Makes me very happy. Thank you so much for admitting that, Carson. Now,
that's a soundbite I'm not going to live over.
No, you're not. Mark's going to create a nice one for that.
That's awful.
I can't wait. Perfect. Well, thank you again for joining us today. Today, we're actually going to be talking about some really common CFI debates. As you know, I used to own a flight school, and I used to get in very heated, I don't know, kind of livery. Is that a word?
Lively.
Lively. There we go. Lively debates. Lively. I don't know what I'm saying right now. Lively debates with other instructors, and I would hear instructors talk amongst themselves.
And Brandon couldn't keep his head out of it, so of course he had to jump right in. And yeah. I was sitting at the desk. I'd hear it all happen and watch it go down.
And I loved having those debates and conversations. And I would even have debates with the FAA on their 141 regulations. I actually looked up an email yesterday to one that I kept on explicitly asking my inspector a question, like, can you direct me to where this is said? And I found out he never got back to me on that. It's really weird. And I asked for like 7 times.
Should follow up again.
I'm not going to follow up. He's no longer my point of contact. I'm just listed as a assistant chief on that now. So it's not my monkey, not my circus any longer.
No, it's not.
So that's up to them. But here's a big one. I don't like when the FAA and different FISDOs reinterpret the regulations and then try to explain them in a way that is not said on either a regulation or a letter of interpretation from the FAA. So I really do think if the FAA is listening, and I know you are, I know you've listened a couple times and reached out to me. So if you are doing that, please, I mean, we need to go by the letter of the law and the regulations. I think it's really important.
Can you explain what a letter of interpretation is?
Yeah, a letter of interpretation is something that comes out. So when you have I don't know of an exact example, but I'll give a simple example of what a letter of interpretation could be. So if we had on there in part 61 and it says, hey, you must do a cross-country flight to another airport within, and it didn't say how many miles, right? Just said you need to do a cross-country and you didn't know what a cross-country meant. A letter of interpretation could have said, and I probably should pull up a legit one for this conversation, but nevertheless, a letter of interpretation could say, hey, you have to be at least 50 nautical miles or more.
Got it. Okay. So it's just explaining exactly what that requirement is or a piece of regulation is.
Exactly. And I actually think there's a letter of interpretation on what considers it a high-performance aircraft because it was like over 200 horsepower. So everybody was trying to figure out, is 200 horsepower considered high-performance aircraft? The answer is no. It has to be 201.
201. Yeah.
Yeah. So there are a bunch of letter of interpretations. You can look them up. But
has
basically,
that become the law everywhere?
Once it's not a law, it's a regulation.
Or, I mean, letter of the law, right? Like the rule.
Becomes the rule, yeah. Okay. And those get pushed out, I think, sporadically throughout the year, kind of depending on what it is. We should do a little bit of research before I start talking extensively on letter of interpretation.
Oh, it's an interesting topic, though.
On the spot for that. I haven't talked about a letter of interpretation for a very long time, so I don't know what the rules and regs are for them.
You're welcome.
Off the top of my head. See, and this is something you could like debate with CFIs. They're like, well, until there's a letter of interpretation, no one knows the answer. And that is true. No one really does know the answer. Let's start off with a couple easy ones for us to go through and see how far we get. We've got like 30 of these things on here. The first one we're going to talk about is stick and rudder skills versus automation reliance. Carson, what's your opinion on it, even though you're not CFI?
I love automation. I think it's just part of what I do for work is automating things. Mm. But just being able to sit back and relax, but also really focus on less labor-intensive tasks. So when you have automation in a cockpit, you know, you have autopilot keeping you straight and level and heading in the same direction. I want to focus more on situational awareness, radios, and really everything else besides actually physically flying the plane.
And my perspective on this is I don't think you should use any automation whatsoever until you already have your private pilot certificate. Never even touch the autopilot.
You know, I heard that question totally wrong then, because I agree with that. I'm thinking of after private pilot.
Oh, you're thinking after private pilot. Yeah, I guess that's true.
Yeah, and I don't think a student pilot should know what autopilot does even, or how to turn it on.
I want
you're going to get yourself into problems.
I want them to know how to turn it off.
Yeah, that's an important one.
And that's all I would probably teach on that. I actually would say until you're midway through your instrument rating and you can do approaches on your own, stick hand flying it, you shouldn't even use an autopilot for that.
Yeah, your core skills aren't there.
Correct. I mean, I took my instrument rating, I took my double I, all without an autopilot, by the way. And I was able to do it. If I could do it, maybe not anybody can do it. It's true. Wink, wink. No, I'm just kidding. No, I mean, I really don't think you should be relying on automation that much until you become really comfortable with the airplane. So I like both, but I'm really into stick and rudder skills as a base pilot. You need to know how to fly that airplane. Because if your autopilot goes off or your moving map turns off or something, you really need to understand how to get to certain places. For example, I use my moving map a lot, either on my phone or my iPad or in the aircraft. By the way, if you go from Southern California to Vegas, they turn off the GPS in between that route quite often. Guess what? Moving map stops working. So you might not need to have charts in your plane or anything old school. You can have your electronic flight bag, but you need to be able to look at that map and be like, okay, well, this is approximately where I'm at. I need to make sure I don't go into this controlled area that I'm not allowed to be in, like a restricted area on the way there. There's a whole bunch of them. There's like a corridor that you have to fly through to make sure that you don't enter any of them. So I think those are some really big reasons why you should really learn how to stick and rudder fly it or not rely on moving map automations.
Just having fundamental skills. Yeah.
It is. It's important to have.
Like it's like getting the car driving and putting Austin in the driver's seat. Has he driven before? Like, you know, quad or an ATV? He has the concept? Sure. Mm-hmm. Is it a good idea? No.
No.
He doesn't drive all the time.
No, I mean, he knows how to drive. I've let him drive.
Well, he can fly an airplane and land it, so.
He can fly an airplane and land it. Yeah. It's been a little while, though. His first flight was last week or 2 weeks. He needs to fly more.
We all do.
We all, especially you, Carson.
Yeah.
All right. Next question.
Ooh, this is a good one. Is ground school overrated or should flight instructors teach primarily in the air? I understand why teaching in the air.
No. No.
Can be beneficial.
Can't even hear me, but I keep saying no when my face goes near that camera.
However, I do not think that a student's first time being introduced to a topic should happen in the air.
Oh, thank
I think
God.
The air.
Something good came
That's
why out
you
of
should
this.
Let me finish my sentence.
No. You started off with bad words. I had to cut that real quick.
Ground school is a really important part of flight training, and it's not something you can skip. There's no way that the air should be the first time a student can be introduced to a topic. Say you're teaching airspace and you're in the air trying to teach a student, you know, that's the Charlie right there. That's not going to make any sense, right?
I think that's a bad example.
Yeah, that's a terrible example.
All right, so here's a better example. You can't teach airspace in the air. That's impossible.
You want to bet? I bet I could do it.
No.
I'll put maps up all over the windows.
Yeah. Yeah, you'd be IFR all the time. I love it.
Yeah, it's fine.
No, I mean, if you're going out and you're trying to teach somebody how to do slow flight or something like that, the place is not to introduce somebody completely to slow flight and then maybe a stall in the air. I was, by the way, that's how I was taught. I was taught in the air what slow flight and what a stall was.
And you see how you fly, so.
Exactly. Amazing.
Amazing. That's what I meant.
Yes. But I should not have been taught that way.
Well, it's an overwhelming environment already.
It is, and I was scared. I was scared of flying the plane that slow. I thought the engine would just turn off. I didn't understand all the concepts.
Well, you hear stall on the ground your whole life, and that means your engine, you know, kind of seizes in a car. Mm-hmm. So when you think of a plane stalling, you're thinking the same thing.
Correct.
Engine failure. Everything's going down. We're all dying. No, yes. That's not it.
That's not it at all. And I did learn that way. And I did learn it, by the way, but I don't like it. I think that you definitely need to learn these concepts on the ground and get an understanding of them and then go practice them in the air. And if you're really just kind of curious and you want your instructor to go demonstrate something for you, okay, sure. Maybe you could go do it one time. But just know that that's just a demonstration. You're not really learning very much there. I mean,
well, it's also how you get those aha moments, right? You learn on the ground. So you learn slow fly on the ground, talk about it, go over everything, see pictures of it even, and visuals and demonstrations. And then you go in the air and do it. And you're like, aha, that's what we just talked about. I understand. And it creates a more well-balanced understanding. and just a better learning environment.
Absolutely. I agree. All right. Next one, touch and goes versus full stop landings. This one I have all sorts of opinions on, and it all depends on the student. So if the student is progressing pretty slow, you need to do full stop taxi backs. If the student is progressing really quickly and their landings are getting better and better, I like touch and goes, especially if they are really grasping the concept of putting the flaps up, pushing the power in, going around, waiting until they have the correct airspeed, all of that stuff. I'm in for that. And they're also good at using the brakes properly, not just like slamming on and getting flat spots and costing the flight school $500 every 5 minutes, stuff like that. But I will say, if you're flying a complex aircraft, I am against you doing touch and goes in training. They don't make sense. So any complex aircraft, that means an aero, that means all twins, no touch and goes. I'm against it.
What's the reason?
Because you say flaps up, full power, right? What does a flap switch look like? It doesn't actually look like it, but what does it feel like when you put it up?
Flat.
Like a gear. Feels like a gear lever. So I would not want to accidentally put my gear up when I'm doing a touch and go on a complex aircraft.
Isn't there like a squat switch?
Yes.
So it doesn't happen?
Oh, you want to get into that, huh?
Oh, my gosh. I remember. Oh, man, that was like a deep memory flashback. The first time I had this talk with Brandon, he got just as heated and gave me that same, you want to go there face?
And when I say complex, it doesn't necessarily have to be a full complex. I really mean the gear. Any airplane that has gear. Like my Icon, I don't think that you should practice touch and goes in that unless you are, I don't know, really on your stuff. I mean, I do touch and goes in it. But if you accidentally put the gear up in that airplane, guess what it does not have, Carson? A squat switch. Does not exist in that airplane. If you put it up on the ground, it will come up.
Oh.
Yeah.
Is that an expensive problem?
Yeah, very expensive problem. It's a crash problem. So outside of that, and it's probably because of the, I don't know, it being able to put the gear down in the water or something. I don't really know why it has it.
Sure, there's a good reason.
Sure, there's a good reason. At least I would hope there is. I brought it up several times to the manufacturer and they didn't do anything, and they're also bankrupt now. So you never know.
Maybe there's not a good reason.
Maybe there's not a good reason. Outside of that, squat switches can fail, number one, on certain aircraft. Number two, when you start gaining airspeed, some squat switches are based on airspeed and some are based on like weight on wheels, right? They're either touching something or they're based on a pressure switch within your pitot system. So it depends on which one. Now, the one with the squat switch on it, as soon as you come a little bit off the ground, you have a little bit of lift, it could come up and you might not have enough lift to take off. So therefore, your wheels start coming in and you just sink a couple feet and basically you crash or you prop strike. So there's one bad problem. The other one, well, if it's not calibrated properly for the pressure switch or the pressure switch is old or whatever it might have happened to it, that could equate to the same exact problem. So
it's also a terrible habit to get into, but
it would be a terrible habit to get into. Yeah. I mean, if
then you go fly an Icon and can you imagine being in the habit of putting just having your gear up?
I heard people where they'll take off and put the gear switch up and they'll just keep their pressure on the ground until they have enough airspeed and then they'll pull up. Like old school pilots have told me crazy stories like that. Like, oh yeah, I throw it up as soon as I start the rollout. And I'm like, you are a complete idiot.
That's a terrible idea.
I would never fly with that person ever in my life.
It saves you infinitesimally small amount of time.
Correct. But there's a lot of people that, especially, I don't know, older pilots, I guess, according to this non-scientific statistic that I'm giving you, that will just take off and forget to put up their gear. And now I know I forget to put up my gear every once in a while too.
Time I did it, it freaked me out. I couldn't figure out what was wrong.
Yeah, you're like, why am I not climbing?
Yeah, and I think it was Ian, and he was sitting there just like, huh.
I wonder why. Have you done
your checklist? And I was like, yeah, no. He's like, okay, well, why don't you run the checklist? Gumps. Gas? Okay. Oh, there we go.
Well, Gumps is a landing checklist.
Yeah, but you can do it the other way, can you not? For being at level flight?
I guess you could. Kind of, but that means you missed your...
how else was it going to give me a
climb
hint?
Checklist? Oh, I guess that's a good point.
Yeah.
Yeah, not too bad. Okay, so now I think we beat this pretty much up.
I think so.
All right, next one. Soloing early versus soloing later.
Well, I've known an instructor that let a student solo at like 5 hours.
Really?
Mm.
That's stupid.
Yeah, he started a flight school after that failed, so...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And I also know of a massive flight school across the United States that solos them in about 50 hours. So there's two very different opinions there.
Yeah. When did you solo, Carson?
Soloed at like 17 hours.
Okay. That's pretty early. in general. I soloed really early at like 10 and a half or 11 hours.
Oh, that's right. I soloed at like 9.5 or 10.
Yes, of course, try to beat me.
That's right.
No, it wasn't like a contest on it. It was just like... No,
whenever you solo, it's just that's when you solo.
Yeah, and mine was over a decade ago. Things changed a little bit since then. Regulations have gotten a little bit stricter. Not tremendously in 11 or 12 years or whatever it's been, but a little bit more. So I will say, I think that the right time to solo somebody is when it's their time to solo them, right? But I don't detract from the schools like ATP, which you just said, and there's several other schools across the country that also do it, and they solo them after their cross country. They basically do their first solo and then first solo cross country. So they really give them all of the tools so they don't crash. And I like that concept because it really prepares the student. But if you're a student that needs to see progression and you have these milestones in your head that, hey, I have to learn these tasks, then I have to solo, then I need to do a cross country, then I need to do a solo cross country, then I need to do check ride prep, then I need to do my check ride. If you are in that mindset, you're not going to do well in that, right? For me, my whole goal was I won't feel like a real pilot until I solo. I mean, that was what I felt. So I was like, I need to solo quick. I need to get my private at 40 hours. I need to do this. And that was like my goal. And I also had no money because I was financing this myself. And I only
you really needed to solo quick.
I really needed to do this faster because if not, I was going to run out of money and never be able to finish. I remember when I originally started flight training, I said to everybody, I'll do this over 2 or 3 years. And then I did over like less than 4 months.
That's crazy to think about it now. Because if someone said that to me, I'd be like, you're not going to ever do it.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I truly thought I would be able to do it over 3 or 4 years.
That's crazy.
Because I was looking at how much flying I could do. And I did it all for $8,500.
Well, yeah. Typically, it's cheaper the faster you do it.
Yeah, it is cheaper, faster. Yeah, and I thought I could spend $2,000 a year.
You can. And you'll do it for the next 10 years.
Correct.
I don't think there's ever a too late to solo. You've had students that soloed at
70 hours.
Yeah. And those students become pilots?
They have all become pilots. I don't give up on anybody. They only give up on themselves. Now, I do think there's a difference between people that can be a private pilot and people that can be a commercial or like professional pilot. I think there's some people that are unable to do that, unfortunately. But it's not huge. It's just you might either need enough more work at it or just your brain doesn't work that way. You're not analytical enough.
It's a whole other language you're trying to learn. Yeah. There's nothing wrong with being a weekend warrior, right? You see the airport's full every weekend.
It is. It's full.
So there's plenty of people
having a great time.
Yeah. It's plenty of fun.
You know what time it is, Carson?
Time's a brain.
It's time to talk about one of our favorite companies.
Which company would that be?
Aviation Mentors is excited to be sponsored by the one and only Stratus Financial, dedicated to supporting the next generation of future aviators.
You know, Stratus Financial really understands the financial challenges that students face in pursuing their aviation dreams. That's why they offer student loans specifically tailored to aspiring pilots.
With competitive rates and flexible repayment plans, Stratus Financial helps take your aviation education to new heights.
So go visit their website today at www.stratus.finance. Just to be clear, that is not .com, it's .finance. And embark on your journey towards a sky full of possibilities.
Carson, it's time to get back to what we do best.
The show.
The show.
All right, Carson, what's the next one we're going to tackle on this?
I think a really interesting one is about your favorite subject, weather. How much real-world weather should a student experience?
Whether or not you feel about... No, I'm just kidding.
Nice.
I couldn't help myself on that one. I think that when you are a student pilot, there is no reason for you to go experience real weather. You should not be going flying IFR when you're going to do your hood work. I did it for I got 0.3 or 0.5 of actual IFR when I was working on my private.
Why? Was that something that just happened to happen?
Well, we wanted to go, kind of. We wanted to, I don't remember why. I think that it was about to clear up, but we had to get out and to go somewhere. Maybe we wanted to go to lunch or something. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the reason was, but ended up getting 0.5 of actual. And I was asking for actual. I wanted to find out what it felt like to fly in a cloud. And
because it looks so soft from the ground.
Yeah, it looks so soft. It doesn't so look nice. All bumpy and terrifying for a new student, at least. Yeah. But it is bumpy, by the way. If you haven't flown through a cloud yet, it is bumpy.
And wet.
And wet. Yes. Cloud is made out of water vapor. So, yeah. So I don't think that you should do a lot of it as a private or even as a IFR student. But if you want to become an IFR student, I think it's really valuable later on in your training that you try to get a couple hours of actual in so you know what it's like. The first time you go fly an actual versus simulated with a hood, it's a world of difference.
I think I actually got about 4 hours of actual and a couple hours of just terrible weather. I remember when it was bad weather before you were my instructor, I had asked to go up and see what actual was like. And I remember there was a day that there was wind shear and just really bad turbulence. And I think it was probably just moderate, but I thought it was terrible. I was like, mm-hmm. This is the worst thing ever. But I wanted to know what I should do if I had actually gotten myself into that situation. So we went up and experienced some actual. I learned how to deal with wind shear and how to handle that. And that was all when I was 30, 40 hours. Yeah. So, yeah, and it got to that point, and I had seen so many people cancel flights because of it, but they also got stuck in it. And I wanted to know, you know, eventually it's going to happen where I get stuck in that situation. Maybe not flying into, you know, actual IFR conditions, but I was like, what would happen if I got in that situation? I want to know how to get out, even if it's just a couple hours of, you know, watching someone else do it, even knowing how to handle that and more confident.
Yeah. And also you could practice a lot of that on a simulator, which I highly recommend.
Yeah. But nothing's shaking you and your hands aren't getting, you know, clammy.
Well, maybe find a full motion sim.
Have a friend kick your chair.
Exactly. All right. I think we've got time for one more, Carson.
So the question is glass cockpit versus steam gauges. Should student pilots learn on a glass panel first? I think absolutely not.
I think it doesn't matter.
Really?
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
Tell me why.
But I do think that they should learn how to fly both. Doesn't matter because you wouldn't know the difference between steam gauges and glass cockpit if that's all you learned on, right? But you definitely need to fly both. I know a lot of people that start on complex aircraft that are brand new and all they have is glass panels and they get into a cockpit with steam gauges and they're like, what is this? Well, guess what? One of your first flight jobs might not have a glass panel. You might need to know how to fly it. It's important. I could tell you I did not fly a glass panel until I bought my aero, and I probably had 300 or 400 hours. And to be honest, my first time ever flying it was the first time I ever flew a glass cockpit.
Was that a quick flight around the airport, or was it a longer flight?
It was from San Diego to Chino, or San Diego to Riverside.
Oh, so you had some time to get used to it and figure it out.
I did. I figured it all out. Yeah. At least I knew where the airspeed was. And
yes. I can just imagine taking it up. It looks like we're going fast enough. We'll figure it out in the air.
No, I mean, I knew where everything was. Yeah, I got really acclimated to
but
it.
But it's something.
But I would say most people should have training. Don't do what I did, and no training on glass cockpit.
There's even simulators or
GTN 750 simulator is really good, actually.
Yeah. Like yeah, just on an just iPad. An app. Yeah. So something just that easy. But I think the skills are not necessarily 100% interchangeable, especially going from glass to steam. There's a lot more to look at and get used to what you're looking at and where you're looking. With, you know, a six pack, you're not going to see all your stuff in one nice little line like on a glass cockpit.
But you kind of are because it's a six pack and it's all in the same exact spot. But if you fly other airplanes, it will be in different spots. And I'll tell you this, when you're flying a different type of aircraft, even the same type, you can be flying a 172N and a 172M model, something like that. And you can just interchangeably go from one cockpit to another and they could have the exact same radios, but their cockpit might be just off a little bit. Now, whenever you're on your scan is now off by like 2 inches, or it could be, I'm using the 2-inch example, but if it is, you're probably not going to be able to fly that airplane as well as the other one. Your reaction time is going to be half a second or a second later because now you're having to move your eyes to the correct point.
You're not going to be in the same exact spot. That's what I was thinking.
And I will say that when you go from glass to a six pack, it's going to be very similar to that.
What about from the other way around, six pack to glass?
Similar, exactly.
Because I remember it felt like there was a lot more to look at.
Just, yeah, there's a lot more.
So many colors and things going on. And
but it's the same information. You're looking at the same six pack. It's just condensed in a different way. So the answer is yes, that's what's happening. But I mean,
that makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, going on to the next question.
Last one for the day. For flight versus and iPads in flight training, should CFIs encourage it or limit tablet use in the cockpit? And this is a touchy subject for me because there's a lot of CFIs that use it with their little Stratus ADS-B and they just plug it in onto the side and they're like, oh, now I know where all the traffic's at and I can use this for situational awareness. And
I don't have to look outside anymore.
Yeah. They don't necessarily say that out loud, but that's their intent. They think it, they don't do it. Well, newsflash, everybody, ADS-B is not required in all the airspace, especially where people do flight training at. Guess where the most dangerous places for you to probably rely on not looking outside is? The place where you're doing flight training in practice areas.
So it's your practice area along with everyone else that can find it.
Correct. And those people do not have to have ADS-B in a lot of those areas. A lot of them. I know there's one here in Southern California at Lake Matthews. Lake Matthews does not require ADS-B, that practice area.
There's so many people there. They really should. I understand why it doesn't.
Can't.
There's so many people.
But there's a lot of people. So you need to be looking outside. Your iPad telling you this information that there's an airplane around you is great.
Also, if you're staring at your iPad the whole time and then you have to find that plane, it takes a lot longer. You know where to look, but it's not the same as a pilot reporting it and you being on the scan 24/7 and looking out the window.
I mean, I like it there just if you're actually truly using it for situational awareness, but I don't think it increases safety. And I would love to see a study done on that at some point. If it actually increases safety in those situations.
That'd be cool to see.
In those situations. I mean, above 10,000 feet, I'm sure it increases safety because that's where it's required, right?
Sure. But below that, I think it would distract from an airplane that doesn't have it.
I would agree. Yeah.
I think it would be a distraction.
And that's the problem. Either we all have to have it everywhere or not really at all, but that's not going to happen.
But what about for other purposes of using ForeFlight as a map for a student?
I learned on paper charts and I flew it via paper. I do think that way is a lot harder. And
Are you opposed to students learning just charts and not touching an iPad till after they're private?
I'm not opposed to it, but I will tell you, if you're not used to looking at maps, and I know this generation is not used to looking at a paper map, it's going to be really hard to teach them that. So they need to have backups to their backups, like three versions of a map, a moving map in their airplane. And they really need to understand pilotage and dead reckoning.
Well, there's not a lot of literacy there with maps.
There's not in our generation. Well, my generation, maybe.
My
generation, no. My son's generation, absolutely not. 0% on maps besides Apple Maps. And
Apple Maps doesn't work in the
air. Google Maps. Yeah, Apple Maps doesn't work in the air. You're right.
All right, cool. These are fun.
These were fun. So yeah, there's some interesting. We'll do a part two of this next week. Thank you so much for this. We have like 40 of these things. We might even do a part three. This was fantastic. So nice job, Mark or Carson, whoever did this. Never know.
It was Mark.
Who to thank? Oh, Mark.
Yeah, you can thank
Mark. Mark the producer, thank you. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it. Please make sure that you go visit. What do you want them to visit, Carson?
Oh, there's this big conference going on. I can't remember the name, but I know it had our company's name in it, right? It was Stratus Aero Summit. How could I forget? It's going to be in Vegas.
May 21st through 23rd. So what is the Stratus Aero Summit, Carson?
Oh, man, it's going to be amazing. There's going to be, it's essentially a conference, but for aviation. So there's going to be flight schools. There's going to be a couple airlines, I think, hiring, right?
A couple airlines will be there.
That'll be fun.
Your peers, flight instructors, and
some student pilots.
And some student pilots.
Yeah, that'll be a lot of, oh, man, it's going to be so cool.
And a ton of vendors. I know that Flying Magazine is going to be there. That's always fun to kind of see. The Kings from King Schools, they are our keynote speaker there, and they're really, really nice to
meet.
The Kings, the one and only. And they're actually bringing their jet.
What?
Yeah, the Falcon, the King Falcon. I'm excited
to
go see it.
Cool. Okay.
Yeah, so we can go check that out. But if you don't come to the conference, we won't be able to check out the jet. We also have aircraft manufacturers there, kind of showing you their new aircraft, all sorts of fun things.
Oh, it's like a whole show day.
There is a show day, yeah. And I know that for student pilots, we are giving them away tickets right now, but they are extremely limited, and we are about out of them. I think we've already have like 30 people that have bought them or taken them, the free ones. And I don't know how many we're giving away more, but there's not that many more that we're giving away. And the code for that is Stratus Special. And I know for flight instructors, there's one as well. Carson, what is that?
That is CFI Special. That's a $50 ticket.
Perfect. I think our tickets are like $300, $400, $500. I can't remember how much they are. They're not cheap per se, because it's a very expensive thing to put on, if you didn't know.
I didn't know how much it was until we started doing it. So.
It's a lot, just to so you know. But thankful for all of our sponsors and people who have bought tickets already. It's going to be a fantastic event. We're looking forward to seeing you there. Also, there's another podcast that actually I am hosting along with my co-host, Alon Rios, over at Stratus Financial. It's called the Alternative Income Blueprint Podcast, or for short, the AIB Podcast. I'm really excited that it launched recently. I'm excited that episode is out now. And you can go find it on YouTube and anywhere that you can find the Aviation Mentors podcast. It's talking about alternative income. And if you're an investor, how to get involved in different types of investment, not just in aviation, but all types of investment. I know that coming up, I believe there's even an episode. It might be out by the time you guys hear this one. And it's on alternative investments like Bitcoin and art and wine, of course. As you know, I love wine. Stuff like that. So if you are interested in investments or different things to multiply your money, please check it out. There is a disclaimer at the end because we're not financial advisors and not giving financial advice, but we are talking about fantastic topics. So
that's super cool. Good job.
Thank you.
Proud of you.
Yeah, it's pretty fun.
Yeah, and I think we can throw you a bone and put a link in the description.
Oh, I appreciate that. By the way, you'll notice that it has the exact same background as this. So I'm looking forward to having you there. Lastly, as always, if you'd like to reach out to either one of us, you can reach us on our emails. It's Brandon@AviationMentors.com or Carson@AviationMentors.com. Don't forget to hit like, follow, subscribe, all the things. If I'm not hitting this mic around, it really helps us grow the aviation community and, of course, help us grow the podcast.
And as we wrap up for the day, remember, here to guide you in your aviation journey. So fly safe and enjoy the ride.
See you guys. Thanks.